Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Gable, and I am the editor of the TLS. Thea is away this week, and I get in trouble for suggesting she's skiving off somewhere. So I'll say nothing more. I think she is skiving off somewhere. Alongside me instead this week is features editor and minister of fun, commissioning editor for TLS Books, of course, Roz Dineen. Roz, hello.
Hi. I've got lots of jobs.
You do have lots. They're all good jobs, though.
No, they are. Just,
I think you've got, in some ways, you've got the best jobs.
I do.
Yes?
Thank you.
Do you believe that?
I do believe that, yeah.
Good. Where do you stand on cheese and fish?
Oh, gosh, I don't care.
You don't
care? This is the tuna melt thing.
It's the tuna melt thing. But Eric Rauchway, who's a noted American historian, took to Twitter, as they say, to challenge Thea's orthodoxy on this and said, shellfish are different from fish. Shellfish can have cheese.
I think everyone can do what they want.
Oh,
do you know, I actually care so little about it that I Googled it to have something to say and I found something out.
Go on.
It's just because when these recipes in Italy,
try and sell it a bit.
When these Italian recipes were made,
yes,
the people who made the good cheese,
yes,
were landlocked and didn't get the fish, and the people who... were at the coast and made the fish recipes.
Didn't work near the cheese.
Didn't go and get the cheese. They didn't need it because they had the fish. And so actually it's just like slow food. And that's why these rules came about. But that it's actually just geographic thing.
That was borderline interesting.
Thanks.
And thank you for taking the time to research
it. You're very welcome.
This week we've got a very special subs offer for our podcast listeners. You can try the TLS digitally and delivered to your door for just £5 or $5 for 6 weeks. That's the best deal out there. So listen up if you want to subscribe. If you're in the US or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com/pod19. Is that clear, Roz? Did you get that?
Yeah, round of applause.
Yeah, podcast.the-tls.com/pod19. And if you're anywhere else in the world, including the UK, go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. That made more sense, I think. I'm getting there. I'll say that again next week. There, if you want to do that, you get the best deal out there. This week on the show, we have a life writing special in the paper, and it's led by a piece on the king of biographers, Robert Caro, still writing his life of Lyndon Johnson, but pausing to share some tricks of the trade in a memoir. Ruth Skirr, a very fine biographer in her own right, will tell us more. From a modern master to a figure from the ancient world, Diogenes Laertius, who wrote Lives of the Eminent Philosophers, a great, eccentric and often inaccurate guide to early thinkers. It sounds a lot of fun. Dimitri Leviton has been reading it for us. And why bother with literary criticism? Something of a dangerous question for the TLS, you might think, but Michael Lapointe has answered it anyway. Should we really be bemoaning the death of the critic? He'll let us know. Robert Caro is one of the great living biographers involved in one of the major life-writing projects of our time. But Ruth Skirr argues this week that he's often mischaracterised and misunderstood as simply writing big books about great men for a male audience. Instead, Caro's lifelong subject is simply political power, as his new book Working makes clear. That method is in essence one of meticulous and personal research, whatever the cost. When writing about the isolation of Lyndon Johnson's upbringing in Hill County, Texas, for example, Caro moved there himself, much to his wife's annoyance. Such assiduous persistence comes at a cost. He's 83 now and his oeuvre is incomplete. He's still working on the fifth volume of The Years of Lyndon Johnson and promises his own major memoir too. Working is, according to Skirr, an insurance policy or safe deposit box against the march of time. It provides us with valuable insight into the Caro approach and his two complementary interview techniques. Long pauses... He has a code, SU, for shut up, which populates his notebooks, coupled with repeated questions. Let's try them now on Ruth Skerr, who's reviewed Working this week. Ruth, hello.
Hello.
I'm not going to shut up yet, but I shortly will. Why is he seen as macho? I guess that's the first question, because you say it at the beginning of your review. He's seen as this big man writing about big men.
Sure. So I think the size of his books, most of them over 1,000 pages long, and the subjects that he chooses. But it's also to do with the way they're marketed. So when I was doing this piece, I asked the publishers to send me the most recent paperback of Caro's first book, which was about Robert Moses, the master builder of New York, published in 1974, never out of print. And they'd reprinted 38 endorsements of Caro's work, from the great and the good, scholars, politicians, and only two of those endorsements were from women. And you have to wonder, what kind of message does that send?
And is there something about the idea of manspreading and mansplaining in all of this? Is that the thought that is something masculine about big thousand word butch volumes of prose?
No, I think it goes through the whole industry. I think if, you know, perhaps a book like that arrives on a commissioning editor's desk, obviously not at the TLS, and they send it out to a male reviewer, and then that male reviewer gets quoted in endorsing it and selling it, and it's a sort of self-perpetuating idea that actually that kind of book is what you buy your father or your brother for Christmas.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it?
Is that a justified position? Because from your review, I get the sense that his books are very much about the human cost of economic power, and they're very careful, and they're about, you say, necessary trespass. It doesn't actually sound that macho, the work, when you describe it like that.
I completely agree, and that's what the revelation really of this new book, Working, where he kind of takes you a bit behind the scenes and explains what he's trying to do and what his approach actually is. And there he's very clear that, you know, in order to understand power, you have to understand the powerless over whom it's exercised. You don't just interview powerful people, you interview the people who didn't have power, whose lives were disrupted by the exercise of power.
Because he starts out as a journalist, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right. So he started out as a reporter on the New Brunswick Daily Home News in New Jersey. And that was where he had the experience of riding the poles with his boss and seeing a group of African-American protesters being basically forcibly removed from the polling station. And he says that at that point he realized, you know, he as a journalist, he as a writer, wanted to be on the side of the protesters. And he got out of the car, according to him, and he found a new job on Newsday on Long Island, which was a paper that sort of championed causes and was more the kind of investigative work that he wanted to do.
And that type of taking trouble to go and find out the facts, that's what he's known for, isn't it? He's sort of the patron saint of research.
So they call it in the trade the sort of doing a Caro, you know, turning over every single stone, being unable to write the book until you've done masses and masses of research. I was actually reminded, though, of the Nobel Prize winner Svetlana Alexievich when I was reading the way he approaches his research, because it seems to me that he's very interested in going and collecting the testimony and finding the people who were eyewitnesses and recording that before it's too late and starts to die out within a generation. And Svetlana Alexievich is an investigative journalist as well. And I think actually there is some overlap in their approaches.
And she interviews people as well over and over again, the same people collecting basically the same information.
One of the parts in Working where I really thought of her was when Caro was describing how when he first went to Hill Country and he wanted to interview some of the women there about what their lives had been like before the electricity came into that part of Texas, they wouldn't really speak to him. So he had assistance from his wife, Ina, who befriended some of these women, and gradually they opened up to her, and then he was able to interview them. But that sort of way of being absolutely determined to try and find a way, whatever it takes, to get hold of the testimony and the evidence is really very powerful.
Is the corollary of that we undervalue him as a stylist? Because he's doing a Caro isn't writing beautiful books. Doing a Caro is actually doing a lot of research. Do you think in some ways he's so good at that we don't recognise the stylist in him?
Well, that is really interesting, and that definitely comes through very clearly in working that it really, really matters to him, his style, how he perceives his work is completely caught up in this idea that writing nonfiction should be no less of a creative artistic act at the level of the prose than writing fiction or writing poetry. So I think it's very, very strong in him. And he says that if he could, you know, he rewrites his drafts over and over again. If he could, he says he'd rewrite the published books. And there's a fascinating story, which had actually been published before, I think, but when the New Yorker excerpted four sections of his first book, they tried to change the prose to make it, you know, conform to their style, or perhaps because they thought it should be different. And he was absolutely berserk, and there's no way he was going to have his style edited in that way.
And is it good? I mean, you've read a lot of him.
I think so. Yeah, I really do. I think he's got it's very spare, it's very compelling reading. I mean, obviously when you open one of these 1,000-page books, part of you thinks, God, is it, you know, is this really gonna be worth it? Am I gonna be able to do this? But then you start to read it, and it is so beautifully and compellingly written that you just sort of fly along.
Is he a whale in a bathtub here, though?
Meaning
that there's five volumes of A Life of Lyndon Johnson. So you have this great stylist, this great researcher, and he's written 5,000-page volumes of A Life of Lyndon Johnson, who and hasn't finished, exactly. And he was Lyndon Johnson was president at an incredible time. But
yeah, he's only just become president.
Yeah, he wasn't an incredible president. He was a one-term president. He's not going to be necessary. If you wrote a list of great American figures, you wouldn't necessarily get to Lyndon Johnson. All I'm saying is it a bit of a shame that he's devoted all of this time to five volumes of a person's life and just got to the presidency?
No, not at all. That's the whole point. The collective name for those books is The Years of Lyndon Johnson. So yes, the focus is Johnson, and he's the main person or the main thread, but it's those years in American history. I mean, that's why people use the word epic about these books, because actually it's a sweep through those times and the movement for civil rights, and then that turning into Vietnam, and all of the things that are happening. And because of the way he works and researches and writes, you have this whole vista on that period of history. So it's not just, you know, this particular man and this is the kind of marmalade he liked to have for breakfast or whatever. It really is projecting onto that broad historical cast list of people.
And that's the America of the 50s and 60s, I suppose. So it is a critical time.
Exactly.
Has he inspired you, Ruth? Because you're writing a big book about a great man in typically macho fashion.
So I got a bit of a shock when Caro's wife, Ina Caro, is quoted as saying to him, "Oh, for goodness sake, couldn't you just do a biography of Napoleon?" And I'm thinking, what does she mean by that? Then we could go and live in Paris and we wouldn't have to live in hill country or something along those lines. But I think what really resonates for me with writing about Napoleon is this idea that in order to understand the powerful, you have to understand their context. You have to understand the obscure people, the powerless people, the people who had the sort of cameo insights into what was going on, and that you can assemble a very interesting portrait of someone by broadening your focus in that way.
So you try to do a Caro, it's fair to say.
I didn't think I was, but now that I've read Working, maybe.
Ruth Sker, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks. Bye.
Lovely. Have you read any, Roz?
What, Caro?
Yeah.
No, I'm going to now.
I'm going to now.
I'm totally, totally sold.
So the first one's called The Path to Power in 1982.
Yeah, and that one's about Robert Moses.
No. That the power broker is Robert Moses.
Oh, sorry.
The first Lyndon Johnson is called The Path to Power in 1982.
Yeah.
And then there's, I think the fifth one, we're just getting to the presidency.
Well, I'd quite like to know, because he's 83 now, so, and he promises to finish the Lyndon Johnson and to write his own memoir, but he might not be able to. I wonder who, if he had all the time in the world, who he'd do next.
Yeah, exactly. Cause,
like, don't you think he'd be quite good on Trump?
Well, no, he's the anti. I really feel he's the anti.
Yeah, but that doesn't make him perfect, because he's not salacious.
No,
he's not going to get engaged in any of it. He's just going to see it.
But the headline for Ruth's piece is a quote from Caro: "The truth takes time," which is about the most anti-Trump thing you could possibly imagine.
Totally.
You know? So I wonder whether we don't live in a world that cares at all about facts, and trying to fact check Trump is maybe just playing a different sport.
Or maybe it's just too soon.
Well, that's a different point. The great writing might take a long time to come. Anyway, should we both go and read it all?
Yeah.
I think there's 5,000 pages.
We could split it up.
Yeah. I'll read the first one, you the second. We'll come back and report.
Okay.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Literary criticism is dead. It's not happening. The golden age is over. Don't believe me? Well, who is the Lionel Trilling of today? Where is our Christopher Hitchens? Who is the modern Sontag? Who is using literature as the source material for their deep investigations into contemporary life? As Michael Lapointe puts it in the TLS this week, the past appears as a zone of glorious combat, in which critics fought hand to hand and books were cleansed in blood. Nowadays, we are too concerned with popularity for this wholesome toughening up. Critics today must be sensitive, politically correct, and inoffensive. 80% of American newspaper and magazine cultural critics have been fired in the 21st century, and their job has been outsourced to anyone with an internet connection. The reviews of a new book on Amazon will likely have more effect on sales than the reviews in any of the remaining literary journals. Reviewing two books in the paper this week, Michael Lapointe questions the veracity or helpfulness of thinking in terms of a golden age of literary criticism, and he joins us now.
Hi, Raz.
The first of the books that you look at for us this week is called American Audacity, In Defence of Literary Daring by William Giraldi. What are Giraldi's fears for criticism?
His main thrust is that critics have lost what he calls audacity, which he seems to equate with a certain sort of intensity, a kind of visionary exuberance or excess that in a way doesn't really have a kind of practical recommendation to it, but is rather a sort of spiritual element, a certain potency to the criticism. And when you begin to read the book and start to analyze what he's really believing is lacking, it has a certain acrimonious feel to it. He seems to feel as though critics are sort of insufficiently energized or on the attack. And this strikes me as being a fairly consistent view with critics of his ilk. I should mention, of course, that it's a book that contains many, many essays, that some of which are very, very strong indeed. Mm. But that the cumulative effect of this collection of essays is to give you the sense that critics today are somewhat flabby or
and they sort of emphasize too much the sort of the feelings that the author produces in the reader rather than the technical precision of the text. Is that his argument?
That's kind of a bête noire of his, is that today's critics are always writing about their emotions, their feelings toward books, as opposed to kind of getting at them on a technical level. And yet at the same time, this technical precision that he feels is lacking is equally lacking is a kind of intensity. Mm. So there's at once there's too much emotion, but not enough passion. And it's in this sort of, it's in this kind of contradiction that the psychological features behind his critique become apparent.
But is the problem, and presumably he acknowledges this, that once you kind of lose deference for authority, which is the sort of spirit of the age, sort of postmodern spirit of the age, critics matter less because people's individual authoritative opinions matter less. So the critics could be writing the most technically precise, daring, audacious, macho reviews in the world, but ultimately the notion of a person setting a trend or passing judgment from on high, that's the thing that we've lost in the culture, not necessarily, which has got nothing to do with the quality of the criticism.
That's a very astute point. At the same time that he identifies the material conditions that have changed, which I think are undeniable to us, it's not quite apparent how this affects the actual practitioner of literary criticism, or affects the work itself. The critic has been knocked off the perch as kind of grand cultural arbiter, but how that exactly affects how you write criticism or what the pleasure of reading strong criticism is, that's not quite as apparent as the critique that he's making.
Yeah, so as you say, it's not the case anymore that the mainstream is a literary critic's entitlement, access to the mainstream, or their right, but they can still continue doing what they're doing brilliantly anyway.
How does that link to political correctness then? So his concern is now, this is the classic plangent moan of the old man that you hear in all sorts of areas, mm-hmm. that his view is that everyone's so desperate to be politically correct, they've lost any form of critical precision.
Yeah, there's a really slippery kind of use of political correctness, emotion, kind of navel gazing. All these things are sort of combined in the work of this writer and others like him. And I guess that links back to his notion of audacity, that if the critic is checked by any kind of fear about being pilloried for not being sufficiently politically correct, then their audacity, their willingness to kind of go that extra distance or say what they really mean is thwarted. And that for him is part of the effect of the sort of the tyranny of political correctness and how it's essentially annihilating the critic's willpower.
What's your rebuttal to that? Do you think he's right?
I don't think he's right. I should say, I don't think he's only right. I think that there are, of course, critics who maybe pull their punches because they feel like they're not being politically correct. But part of my broader point in the piece is that these critiques that he's making of today have always been with literary criticism, even in the period that he kind of holds up as being the exemplary period, the mid-20th century American period. Back then, critics were often complaining about how critics would be too structured by their political ideologies and wouldn't therefore be making a kind of coherent or objective literary analysis because they'd be politically influenced. It's just that today, the politics that critics like Giraldi seem to fear most are identity politics, but, you know, 50 years ago or what have you, it might have been something about, you know, kind of Cold War politics or something like that. But there's always been ideology that has been in tension with literary analysis. So I don't really feel as if the problem is any worse today. It's just the terms of the argument have changed.
And actually, it's ultimately about a loss of status, isn't it? Because 50 years ago, if you were a privileged person, predominantly white male, you could say, I think this book is good, this book is rubbish, and that opinion was in some way set in stone. Now the field for discussion is opened up to people who were previously perhaps silenced, institutionally even silenced, and that's threatening to a certain type of person, isn't it, ultimately, because the field is all of a sudden a lot more populated with a lot more divergent opinions, so no one opinion that you might hold is sufficient to carry the day.
That's right. And that's an argument that it would be interesting to hear one of the critics in question discuss. It always feels as if they're talking about something else when they're talking about, you know, their fear that the literary critic has lost their power. Mm. Because at the same time that maybe the mid-20th century is the period that these critics really admire and there's all this great criticism coming out of it, you can't simultaneously, or one can't simultaneously make the argument that, you know, that period was full of this richness and this depth of literary criticism, and then, you know, ignore how today's literary field has a genuine diversity to it that was simply impossible 50 years ago.
Can I move you on quickly to the second book you looked at for us, which is called Hater by John Zemley. Can you tell us why you hate it so much?
A book Zemley may be pleased to know I truly despise, yes. is the line from the review.
Yeah.
Well, it's called Hater, and it's a book that asks its readers to give respect to the hater, or that the hater can actually be a model for critics. And so, yes, I wrote that, you know, in a way he might be oddly pleased to know that I hated the book, because he does, you know, put the hater up as a kind of exemplary figure. I hated it because the terms of the argument just fall apart so rapidly and so thoroughly that it's a perplexing read and a frustrating one. It struck me as the kind of book that the title comes first, and you think to yourself, oh, this will be fun. This will be an easy kind of a romp of a book to write. Hater, you know, what could be? It would be fun. But once you start kind of actually putting it on the page, the logical implications of the argument become really, really unsavory. And so the whole book reads as this sort of backing away from the term hater, to the point where the term hater just becomes something like free thinker or skeptic, or just a variety of common features that any critic, you know, any halfway decent critic has in the toolbox.
And it includes an unintentional defense of trolling. Is that right?
Well, it becomes that, right? Yeah. I mean, if the premise is that a kind of hater response is a valuable response to virtually any text that you encounter, I kind of fail to see how that doesn't logically become a defense of trolling eventually, because why you should start from a hostile position as a critic is completely arbitrary. There's no reason to it. The only figure in society who functions like that is the internet troll, but who actually, will hate absolutely anything.
But it's just that both of these books seem to me to come from a cliche that may or may not be true, which is a bit of a cliche that everyone always believes. When you get to a certain age, you look around at the namby-pamby milksop youth and say, well, look at them, they don't have strong enough opinions, they don't, you know, run far enough in the mornings, they don't hate enough, they're all too busy, you know, making daisy chains and singing Kumbaya. Old men have said that for as long as they've been old men. They've looked at the young of the today and think, well, they don't know what hardship is. They don't know what tough thinking is. Is it any more than that? Just it's a sort of the angry spasm of certain type of middle age.
I mean, other than the fact that Zemley, as far as I'm aware, is a youngish man, and the same is with Giraldi. He's not like an old man. They might be sort of old before their time in a way.
Young fogies, I like.
Yeah, young fogies. But I do think that the one difference of today from the people that you're describing that are a cliche is that the social media element has sort of thrown a kind of gasoline onto the everlasting flame of this sort of old fogey ire. The opportunity to be outraged is so common now for these figures that there's a certain sort of vehemence and maniacal quality to it that strikes me as slightly unique. You know, it's not quite the critiques stop being sort of measured in a way, and they start becoming really unhinged when they start to engage with social media, which they perceive as sort of being equivalent to the audience or the common reader or whatever.
But the other, I mean, we can't get into this now, but the other question is how you make money from it, because I'm always struck that when you read books of, I think it's an Ian McEwan book where someone basically makes a living in London as a literary critic and has enough money to has enough money to buy a house, you know, buy a flat in some central London. And you kind of think, there must have been a period, and this is probably where the golden age argument has a bit of weight. There was a period where if you were lucky enough to break in to the hallowed halls, you could make a living thinking beautiful thoughts. And now thinking beautiful thoughts is harder to make money from. That's possibly a fair criticism.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't, I think that there's consistently valuable arguments to have about the material conditions of literary culture and how they're changing over time. The only thing that I would ask people to do is just is begin to identify how that Ian McEwan character, him or herself, lived within the aberration. They were the exception, not the rule. The mid-20th century, the post-war period of when, you know, you could get like a six-figure book deal advance for just like pitching a collection of, you know, criticism over lunch or something like that, whatever this great time was, that was the exception, not the rule. I don't think that, you know, materially writers are in better shape than they were two or three decades ago, although many writers of color would probably say the opposite, because they're actually breaking through and doing some of the most important work now. So there's always that element to it as well.
Very true.
But the material conditions, you know, are worsening for a lot. There's a lot of layoffs. There's not as much money floating around. But what I want to resist is kind of having the center of gravity be that period of boom, that is the measure by which we assess the quality of today's literary culture. Materially, we can't deny that it's worse now in many ways. But how that exactly that changes the quality of literary criticism itself as a practice or a pursuit, I don't follow. I don't accept.
That's a very good point indeed.
I think we'll have to end it there.
Yeah, we will. Michael Lapointe, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Diogenes Laertius, profiled by Dimitri Levitin this week, is something of an anti-Robert Caro. In Levitin's words, his authorial strategy seems to have been simple: to throw together every morsel of information that he could get his hands on, with little concern for overall coherence or for the reliability of his sources. The result was The Lives of Eminent Philosophers, published in the 3rd century AD. And Diogenes provides readable and entertaining accounts of his own version of the powerful and patriarchal, ancient philosophers representing that grossly underappreciated demographic, men with beards. So why should we still read him now? Dimitri Levitin makes the case entertainingly in the TLS this week and joins us on the line. Dimitri, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Dick.
You call Diogenes the most ridiculed historian of philosophy of all time. Why is he ridiculed so much?
Well, he's ridiculed because he seems to tell us almost everything apart from what we actually want to know. That's to say, he tells us about philosophers' diets, he tells us about their appearance, he tells us what they wore, he tells us about their sex lives, but he tells us very, very little, and certainly not very accurately, about their actual ideas. And as you might imagine, most philosophers are quite intellectually minded, and they want to know about ideas rather than sex life.
Yeah, I have to say that I probably am interested in the sex lives of philosophers. Who is it? Is it Plato who's the big...
He's certainly given rather a rampaging libido by Diogenes Laertius. Whether that's accurate or not is debatable. Certainly he draws on love poems that Plato is supposed to have written to various young men and women, not all of which were certainly by Plato. In fact, most likely they weren't.
How reliable is he as a source for all these things?
He's pretty unreliable in one way. That is to say, he seemed to have access to a lot of sources which he read completely uncritically. He picked them up off the shelf, transcribed what was into them, whether it contradicted another source or not, and then went on to the next one. So, for example, he'll happily report the story of Pythagoras having a golden thigh, which we can probably assume isn't true. On the other hand, that kind of lack of critical acumen can sometimes be a blessing in disguise, because if someone simply transcribes everything they have, it means that they probably haven't added much of their own, or at least invented much of their own, so we can get on with the task of trying to sort out what's true and what isn't.
And is that why the book is important, do you think, Dimitri? Because it's a source, it's a very early source, and so he would have had access to stuff that's been lost, and so it's just a compendium of interesting information that existed in the 3rd century AD.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to understand that often for these ancient philosophers, although many people have heard of their names, you know, everyone's heard of their Aristotle, their Plato, their Socrates, that might give a kind of mistaken impression that we have a great deal of knowledge always about them, but we know exactly everything they ever wrote, said, or did. But actually, like all knowledge about ancient history, finding anything out about them is a battle. Every sentence that we read, we have to fight with or even against, to read it against the grain, and quite often we have nothing. So something is always better than nothing, and Diogenes' pathological compendiousness makes him attractive in that regard.
He's compendious in the sense of, there's lots of philosophers in it. There aren't very many women. There's only one woman, I think, in it, you see. Why was that?
There are a few relatives, but yes, not many.
Why is that? And could he have included more? Is there a tradition of female ancient philosophy that's underrepresented?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, Diogenes, why he himself didn't include them, since we know virtually nothing about him, is very hard to say. Although, of course, ancient Greece was a pretty patriarchal society in general. The one he does talk about is Hipparchia, who at least wins the argument against the male philosopher that he reports on. So that's a good start. The bad thing that happens afterwards is that the man gets so angry that he pulls up her dress, which is probably rather indicative of attitudes that existed at the time. He certainly could have included more. Well, he couldn't have included Hypatia, who lived a bit after, who people have probably heard of. But certainly in the Renaissance, when Diogenes was rediscovered, very early collections were made of the lives of women philosophers. In the Epicurean sect in particular, it seemed to be totally valid for women to become philosophers, to join the school. And there are fragments of some of their writings that survive and which have been collected and which are often extraordinarily fascinating.
How would he have looked at modern philosophers? Because in some ways, your discussion of him talking about the sex lives and the clothes and the tastes of them feels very modern. It's sort of an accusation about modernity that we sort of focus on the glib. But his approach to the sort of guru figures of the 20th century might have been something similar if he'd have been around now.
Yes, and one thinks that one couldn't always blame him. Philosophers have always sought to present themselves as living the life of a mind. But to live the life of a mind, one needs to eat, one needs to have a roof over one's head, unless that is what is Diogenes the cynic, who lived in a barrel. But one also needs to have a certain degree of independence. In fact, philosophers pride themselves on independence. And independence then as now came with money. And so philosophers have had a tendency to approach those who can sustain their independence, who sometimes tend to be tyrants or other politically dubious figures. I think just recently you reviewed a very nice book about Diderot and Catherine the Great. And of course, Catherine's political rule over Russia went against everything that Diderot preached. And it's been the same in the 20th century. If you think about philosophers of all political persuasions, whether right wing or left wing, so we might think of Martin Heidegger or Jean-Paul Sartre or Michel Foucault, who have quite frankly got into bed with tyrants or supported various really rather nasty regimes, not always necessarily for financial gain, but perhaps out of a sense that they needed to stand out. and be different. And certainly Diogenes would have recognized that as a social type.
You say in your piece that he took a sly delight in mocking many of the philosophers that he wrote about. Was that the basis of his project, or was the basis of it more he was just collecting the stories, or is there a certain amount of envy at work in his take on things?
That's an absolutely fantastic question. And if only we knew more about him, we might be able to answer it better. There are a few things to say. One is that we know that before he wrote The Lives of Philosophers, he wrote a collection of poems focusing almost entirely on the deaths of great men and great thinkers. Now, we know this because some of these appear in The Lives of the Philosophers. They're usually truly terrible, but there is something in them, a kind of focus on the body. You know, Empedocles jumped into a volcano. Another philosopher laughed himself to death after making a not very good joke. So there seems to be something in him of a desire to contrast these men, as we said, usually men, who claim to live of the life of the mind. There seems to be a desire to present them having by necessity to live the life of a body. So clearly there is something mocking there. Having said that, he clearly does respect a lot of them. And there is something very unusual about the very start of the book, where he is incredibly proud, clearly, deliberately, of philosophy being a particularly Greek invention. Now, you might think that that would be a typically Greek attitude, but actually it wasn't. Usually Greeks said, oh, no, no, we got it all from the Egyptians or the Babylonians. They often told stories about how Plato or Pythagoras or Democritus went to learn at the feet of Egyptian sages. So clearly there's an almost kind of, to use an anachronistic term, nationalistic belief in the value or virtue of the Greek mind in Diogenes. So perhaps there is something truly celebratory in his account.
Well, it's you bring him to life just now, Dimitri, and in the piece as well. So we're very grateful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's another book to read after we've done all of the years of Lyndon Johnson.
Ross, got a lot of reading.
Your challenge is to read The Lives of the Eminent Philosophers, and it's a new translation by OUP, and apparently the new translation Dimitri says elsewhere is very good. So, yeah, plenty to read. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Ruth Skerr, Dimitri Levitin and Michael Lapointe. My thanks go to Roz.
Thank you.
You're very well. Thank you. Thank you. Don't thank me. You. Thank you. And we are. I genuinely think we always say we're going to read books based on this. Do you remember about 2 years ago we talked about Dorothy Dunnett? Do you remember that on the podcast?
No.
We did. Anyway, it took 2 years. Matt, our producer, pretending to remember that. Anyway, we did. Dorothy Dunnett writes historical fiction set in sort of Renaissance in Scotland.
I actually do remember this. I remember you saying it.
I'm going to go and read it. And then I found it in a charity shop and I read the first book, The Lyman Chronicles. Very good.
So we
have to go and I think we do have to read the Caro.
Okay.
Make sure you're all using those codes to subscribe to the TLS. Next week we have an issue with a mini special on graphic novels, comics and superheroes. Thea will be flying back for that, I'm sure. Until then, from Roz and me, goodbye.